Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings to all of you listening around the world and a warm welcome as I bring you another edition of the Answers for the Family radio show. I am your guest host and international kindness expert, speaker and author, Gabriella Van Rey. Kindness stands central in everything I undertake. Host Alan Cardoza is absent today because he is, as you know, helping most probably a runaway teen or has to help someone in need. So I'm taking over the last show of the year. And as you all know, worldwide, Monday from 11 a.m. to noon, PST time, this show brings you special guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to life. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, and dealing with addiction, and so much more. Alan tells me to let you all know that he wishes you and every single person that listens to his show a very happy new year. And today we have an amazing guest that I want to get to immediately. His name is Caleb Woods, and he began writing at a very young age to cope with bullying at school, and later to soothe his depressing thoughts. Growing up in a small town in rural Alabama, he was surrounded by religion and found it increasingly difficult to reconcile his faith with his sexual orientation. Caleb was told he would spend an eternity in hell for being gay, and he believed it. He was first officially diagnosed with PTSD in high school after his closest friend died unexpectedly. He moved away to college but ignored his symptoms and didn't seek help for his mental illness. After years of suffering in silence, he began to accept his sexual orientation and eventually met his now husband, Luke. Despite a happy marriage, Caleb continued to suffer PTSD, and the night terrors and panic attacks finally drove him to seek more professional help. His doctor quickly confirmed that PTSD was the diagnosis, and it wasn't something to be taken lightly. Today, Caleb receives treatment for PTSD, panic disorder, and depression by attending reoccurring therapy sessions. Throughout these years, Caleb wrote poetry about his specific struggles surrounding mental illness and growing up gay in the Bible Belt. In his debut book, Harnessing Darkness and Expressing Mental Illness Through Poetry, Caleb reveals his most personal thoughts, some dark, some light, some suffering, some very uplifting, but all existential. Currently, Caleb lives with his husband in Birmingham, Alabama, and he's a full-time writer, author, and poet who enjoys reading, traveling, playing board games, and collecting pop culture memorabilia. Caleb Woods, welcome on this show.
Hi there. It's so great for you to have me on. I really appreciate it.
When I read what you have gone through, I just get goosebumps on my arms because it's truly not fair. Just by reading it, I have the reaction, gosh, that's not fair. First of all, being bullied, I know all about that. But it's not fair because these are things you cannot do anything about. And your sexual orientation, just being told that you would go to hell for eternity, honestly, Caleb, that just doesn't sit well with me. It is yes. Awful. And before we start on anything, would you just, for everyone out there that might be listening, the parents that might have a child that has a different sexual orientation. Would you just address that for a second? What would you say to a parent right now who might be struggling with a child on that topic?
Absolutely. The first thing that I would ever recommend a parent to do in the event their child comes out to them is to absolutely 100% make certain that your child knows that you love them unconditionally. And that means your very first reaction has to be positive. You may be shocked or you may, you know, be taken aback for a moment, but it absolutely, the first, you know, first impressions are everything, and it has to go from the get-go, because in my situation, that didn't happen. And so it caused me to retreat into myself. So I think that parents need to, you know, immediately let their child know how much they love them and that it doesn't matter. And then on top of that, immediately start doing research, you know, anything they can get their hands on, books, documentaries, whatever, to help them understand better. Because at the end of the day, it's your child, and you should do whatever you can and need to do to love them to the fullest.
Absolutely. Caleb, what age were you, if I may ask, when you came out?
I began being bullied pretty extensively in third grade. And so it was probably around fourth or fifth grade when I actually, I mentioned to my parents that I was, you know, I grew up in church. My mom taught a class. My dad was a deacon. And I confided in my mom and I said that I was struggling with, you know, being attracted to men. And it was something that we needed to, you know, kind of pray away. Everybody knew it was bad. We were all taught that it was bad. And so from that very first encounter, I just sort of retreated into myself, like I mentioned, and tried to walk this, you know, straight path and be, you know, act as straight as possible, pray every day. So that began very early on.
And when you say you were bullied, were you actually bullied at school in grade 3, 4, and 5 for your sexual orientation? Or tell me more about it.
Beginning in third grade, mm-hmm. I started being bullied and called, you know, queer, fag, gay lub, you know, any type of feminine, you know, thing that people would associate with me. If I would cross my legs, people would make fun of that, the way I talked, just anything and everything. And that continued all the way through high school, unfortunately. I actually changed schools at eighth grade to get away from the bullying, but I couldn't get away from my sexual orientation, obviously. So my, you know, femininity or whatever you want to call it came with me, and apparently everybody saw something in me that I had even yet to realize. But in fifth grade, the bullying was so extensive that I was home alone, and I actually went into my parents' bedroom, and I knew where my dad kept his gun in the sock drawer. And I grabbed the gun and I sat on the edge of my parents' bed. And this was in fifth grade. And I wasn't trying to decide which way to die. I was deciding which way to go to hell. And I was trying to figure out, do I pull the trigger and die by suicide, which was at the time I was taught would lead me straight to hell. And then, or would I continue living as a gay person, now knowing that it's a sin, one of the most horrible sins out there, the worst, and end up going to hell anyway. For some reason, I did not pull the trigger, but I ended up on a dangerous path of kind of slowly killing myself. I developed an eating disorder, things like that.
That makes me very sad to hear that, because I cannot even imagine what you must have felt like sitting there contemplating that no matter what choice you would take, hell was the end solution in either cases. So that makes me really sad, but that also makes me realize that you had the strength, and I always call that the internal might, you know, that we have when you go through so much pain, Caleb, you found somehow this incredible strength to go forward. And could you a little bit address that? How did you find that strength?
Sure. You know, I really, it was because of probably my family. My mom mm-hmm. was, there's a 12-year difference between me and my brother, and my mom had just had a baby at the time. And I kept picturing that one of the most positive things in my life at that point was my baby brother. And so I just tried to think of, you know, my loved ones and the support system that I could potentially have one day if they could, you know, get over the whole gay thing. So.
Wow. That's actually beautiful. I'm touched that you would think of a baby brother as a future friend and a future ally almost to your situation, right? That's kind of beautiful. And
well, thank you.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about it because you're telling me so much information that it's kind of, wow, this is heavy, Caleb. I cannot imagine the trauma that you're going to. Do you mind sharing a little bit when you did leave? Because you went from elementary school, I'm trying to make a timeline here, from elementary school, you went straight from the bullying that you already have, contemplating to kill yourself, into high school where it didn't stop. Would you say high school was even worse, where you felt even more unseen?
Sure, yeah. After, you know, years and ended up being, you know, a decade worth of bullying, high school began to get worse, which increased my paranoia when, okay, like, you're walking down the halls and people are giggling and laughing, you know, for so much of the, you know, 90% of the time was about me. So every time I always thought it was about me. Mm-hmm. And there was one time in class when I was sitting in the room and there was a notebook being passed around the classroom, and it would go from person to person and it would never stop at me. And that made me curious. So I would kind of follow the notebook around. And when I would look at the person, they would kind of cut their eyes at me and then try to hide the notebook secretively. And so I thought, okay, you know, I have got to get my hands on this notebook. I believe this was about 11th grade or so. And I had, you know, already experienced so many years of this. And I thought, I've got to find out, is this about me? I have to, you know, have proof. I need to take it to the counselor at the school, you know, all this. So a lot of the people that were in that class period were in my next class period. And it was a lunch period, which means you kind of just dropped off your backpacks and things like that. And she called roll, and then you just went to the cafeteria. So I followed the notebook into this guy's backpack, and he was in my next class. And so I kind of, you know, took a little longer getting my lunch money out of my backpack and made sure I was at the end of the line so I could, you know, quickly turn back around and go back in the classroom without anybody seeing me. Mm-hmm. And I was a good student and I made good grades and I was never in trouble. So, you know, no teacher would think of me being, you know, weird in a room alone or anything. So, I go to his desk, I get in his backpack, I pull out that notebook, and all on this piece of paper were just horrible things written about me. It was all the, you know, normal things you would think of, the gay, the queer, fag. It was people saying, well, maybe he has AIDS, maybe he has an STD, or I heard he hooked up with so-and-so, I heard he hooked up with this person, maybe he's bisexual, I heard his private parts are red and itchy and just completely just blew my mind that people were just going into such detail about stuff. I was like, I don't even know where they're getting this or what's going on. And it was just this realization of everybody hates me, you know.
Yeah.
The church won't accept me. Family won't accept me. You know, friends won't accept me. I ended up taking that notebook too, or that piece of paper. I ripped it out and I took it to the counselor at school. And of course, they didn't really do much. They had the kids that had written on it watch a PowerPoint on bullying. And what ended up happening is anytime I was in earshot of them, they would make sure I would hear them. And then they would say stuff like, oh, be quiet. Don't say that. That'll be considered bullying. And then they would like laugh it off. So it was all this complete joke to them.
Yeah. Wow. But what I can concur with you, because I've been bullied a lot as a child, is it especially makes you feel worthless, right? And that's the biggest problem about the bullying, is that you don't feel good enough as a human being, right?
Oh, absolutely. My self-worth was diminishing, you know, bit by bit over all these years. Like I said, I developed an eating disorder earlier into high school. I was placed on a strict Ensure diet, those drinks.
Yeah.
They come in, you know, various flavors. And I just, you know, like I said, retreated into myself and tried my best to continue to pray things away. And at the end of senior year of high school, my best friend from elementary school, who I kind of felt guilty for changing schools because she was also bullied, okay, she had epilepsy and she passed away from a grand mal seizure.
Oh my goodness.
And when that happened, I was the pallbearer at the funeral. And it was very difficult, and I felt I had a lot of survivor's guilt for changing schools and kind of leaving her behind, even though I knew I had to get out for my own well-being. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, I met with a therapist, and this was the first time anyone had ever spoken the words, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder to me. Mm-hmm. And when he told me that I had PTSD, I said, Is that not something, you know, soldiers get, you know, people who've been in a war? And he looked at me and he said, you have been in a war. And I was, mm-hmm, like, what are you talking about? And he said, you, from what you tell me, you know, obviously you've just lost, you know, your best friend. And on top of that, you've had all these thoughts of going to hell because of what you've been told, as well as, you know, 10 years now of bullying and harassment. And, you know, PTSD can exhibit itself in different ways, and you can be diagnosed with it due to any type of trauma. So, mm-hmm, already, you know, senior year of high school, I had bullying and harassment and an eating disorder and the death of a, you know, friend, all this, you know, under my belt that I was carrying. Yeah. So
every traumatic experience just kind of came together. I'm so glad they diagnosed you, though. But I must say that I was pretty ignorant myself on PTSD. And about 10 years ago, I learned that all of us could basically get PTSD, that it's a disorder of being attacked nonstop, right? And seeing things and experiencing things that we should never experience as a human being. And the way your story goes so far, it feels like you experienced more than any human being should have experienced at such an incredibly young age. And I presume you wanted to get away and away from your family and out of the town. I'm not sure that's fair to say, but you went off to college, right?
Right. So absolutely. So the problem here is that once I received that diagnosis, at that point in time, No, yeah, I had already been on anxiety and depression medicine in high school because obviously, but nobody really took that diagnosis seriously.
Okay.
Seriously enough for me to be in, you know, weekly therapy, actually do research on this, things like that.
Did you take it seriously though, the diagnosis?
I was still under the belief that, you know, praying would help. So okay. I didn't think that, you know, oh, science, oh, therapy, you know, none of that was going to fix it, you know, but mm-hmm. God would. But I did know that I absolutely needed to get out of that area where I, you know, lived. I needed to get away from my family, from, you know, the church over there, the school, everything. Mm-hmm. So, which just made it worse because the issue was not addressed. You know, once the diagnosis happened, the issue wasn't addressed, and that just made it 10 times worse. So I go to college, and basically, you know, I think I'm going to hell, so why would I care about anything? So I go to college, I'm opened up to this, you know, new world, I'm promiscuous, you know, use drugs, alcohol, anything to numb the pain that I'm experiencing because life is too hard.
Okay.
And from there, things just kind of get, you know, worse and worse. Like I said,
they escalated.
Yes. There, at one point, I, you know, woke up in the Waffle House bathroom. Wasted, and my friends had to like get a hanger to try to unlock the door. There were many times I would, you know, be drunk driving back to my apartment, just engaging in very like risky behavior. And mm-hmm. I do want to take the time right now to point out the fact that there is, you know, although there may be a high rate of suicide or promiscuity or, you know, drug use or whatever within the gay community, that mm-hmm. might, you know, technically or statistically be real. But we don't go out in search of those things just because. The reason why we turn to these things is to help numb the pain by how we're treated. And
absolutely.
It really bothers me when people say, which has always been used against, you know, gay people a lot, is, oh, well, there's so much, you know, destruction in that community because of the, you know, the sex and the drugs and the da-da-da-da. And it's like, well, we wouldn't turn to those things if you wouldn't treat us so bad. So I do want to, like, you know, distinguish that there.
I love that you did that, because if you hadn't, I would have. I agree with
okay.
you totally that we have, there are only a very few options, but because your path with your family already put you on the path of not being good enough, and then society basically concurred with your parents, and that's all you saw. So there was no other way to live day by day except to numb the pain. I understand that completely, really completely. One thing that I want to just make clear, the college was still in Alabama, or did you get out of Alabama?
Yeah, so the college was still in Alabama. It was about 2 hours away.
Ah, that's a shame.
So, yeah, not too far away. But
I was hoping that you had a chance to go to college in a total different state where you might have been accepted. Could you give me a time frame year-wise when this is, so that people listening to you would understand a little bit better? What year were you in college?
So I was in college in the fall of 2008.
Okay. So I love that you just said that, because the way you made it sound, it almost sounded like it was the 90s or something, and that we didn't know. That's why I'm so glad you said that, because by this time, we all know what being gay was, and I had thought that after the year 2000, we were a lot kinder. And you
not in Alabama.
No, and this is why it's so good that you're talking, because through your painful dialogue here, we are learning a valuable lesson through your story. So thank you. And I'm going to touch on something that is painful, but I have it here in front of me. And unfortunately, the interview is in 2 hours, so I really do want to get this part in, is that you were raped in college. And first of all, I'm so sorry to hear that. But could you tell us a little bit about that? Because rape is prevalent in colleges, and it does make the news quite often. Would you care to touch on that?
Sure. Yeah, so like I said, I was experiencing trauma after trauma after trauma. And then when I went to college, that same thing happened. And of course, at this point, it was, you know, a really big trauma here. And the situation was, you know, at this time, there wasn't a dating app or anything like that, you know, Grindr or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was random people you would add on Facebook or MySpace or things like that. And MySpace was kind of going away. So it was people like you thought you knew and that would be okay. And I was high at the time, and I went to this guy's apartment, and what happened happened. It started out as being a nice thing, and then suddenly it wasn't anymore. And I had to run out there, you know, run away kicking and screaming for him to get off of me. And of course, I did not go to any type of law enforcement because I was high at the time, and I thought, who's going to believe me? You know, I went there willingly. You know, then you begin to blame yourself. The woulda, coulda, shoulda, the guilt, things like that. I had actually, as I said, I was promiscuous, and there was actually a police officer that I had hooked up with in that area while I was at school. And afterwards, he had said, you know, if you tell anybody, I will kill you.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a lot of, you know, like I said, risky situations that I was in. And that once the rape happened, I just completely internalized everything, and it just made everything that much worse.
But something must have saved you, because something, and I have a feeling it's your writing. Am I right about that? That your writing and your need to write this all down and to make it into something beautiful for others kind of helped you through it with the therapy?
So I had a lot of, you know, growing up, I would rot, and that was kind of my way to cope and to escape. Mm-hmm. And that started at a very early age. And I, you know, began journaling and things like that. And for several years in college, basically 2008 to, you know, 2011 or so, it was just a whirlwind of just terrible things. And but then I met my now husband, and mm-hmm. It was no longer a relationship that was just about hooking up or things like that. It was a genuine interest, and it was almost as if you looked past the physical form and, you know, saw the soul of the person. And we were both trying to navigate this sea of, you know, homophobia in our lives. And we watched the movie Prayers for Bobby. I read the book. I would watch this documentary called For the Bible Tells Me So. And we utilized the website called Freed Hearts that Susan Cottrell is over. And we used any resources we could to kind of understand. And basically, we came to the conclusion, hey, you know, we looked at the Bible in the context of the time that it was written and all these things, and we're like, this is not a sin. We have been, you know, bamboozled our entire life, and this is absolutely ridiculous how we've been treated, and we're kind of done with it. Mm-hmm. So in 2012, I came out to my mom again and was like, look, I'm with Luke. We're together. It's not changing. There's no more praying it away. And over the next few years, they got better. And they, you know, my mom read anything she could get her hands on. She really like stepped up and did everything she could as a parent should. And then things were great until my husband came out to his family. And then it was like trauma after trauma happened again, because once he came out to his family, they did not accept it well at all. It, had he been younger, they probably would have just completely disowned him, or he would have had to go to like a, you know, a camp or something. Thank goodness he was of age that he didn't have to do that. But they wanted him to leave me. And by this time we were living together, and they said that I was possessed by a demon. And that I was a demon, and that my whole family was demon possessed. And basically, I was the person who made him gay, and that he was the equivalent of a pedophile and a murderer, and all the things you hear that are told against gay people. And they sent me death threats, and they were like stalking us. And even just last year, after we moved to get away from them so they wouldn't know where we lived, they actually showed up at our front door. And we that actually ended with a cease and desist order. And since then, things have been honestly, you know, way less stressful and all that. And, you know, I'm glad that my parents came around, and, you know, and I'm still sad about my husband's parents. But we spent like 3 or 4 years of our lives trying to convince them to love him. And, you know, at some point, like, look, it's your child. You love them no matter what. I don't care what your belief is, you know. And they couldn't get to that point, unfortunately. And some stories don't have a happy ending, and that one didn't. And, you know, that's kind of how the story went. But during the midst of all this chaos, about 3 years ago, with all the, you know, the death threats and things, I started developing, you know, panic attacks really severely. Sure. And having night terrors, and, you know, getting increasingly agitated and having a lot of the symptoms that go along with PTSD. And so I knew the turning point was me and my husband were in a store, and we were in a Kohl's, and we went straight to the candle aisle, as the gays do. And I had this coupon for this like specific candle, for the Yankee candles. And, you know, they come in all different sizes and shapes and all that, so it's like impossible to decide. So I'm carrying all these candles up to the register, and I'm trying to figure out how to use this coupon. And then I just kind of lose it and just start hyperventilating, and just I don't even know what's going on. And if, you know, anybody who knows anything about PTSD is that like having multiple choices and things to choose from, you know, even driving this certain way to get to the store or driving this way really like has this inner conflict with you, which is why so many people avoid the grocery store, because of so many options and the aisles and things like that. And so we quickly hurried over to like the clothing aisle and hid there. And that was the turning point for me when I knew I needed to be in therapy. And for the past 3 years, I have been in therapy and have since been diagnosed with PTSD and depression and panic disorder, as well as bipolar 2 disorder.
And what is it like to live with mental illness? What does that look like a day in your life? Medicine, therapy, Is it a fight each time, or do you feel like you're getting actually a lot of clarity through it?
Right. So basically, my brain has been completely rerouted to protect me at all costs. So this means that my brain would say things such as like, you know, those people are laughing in the corner. They're laughing at you. You're worthless. There's no need to try anymore. You'll never be loved. So-and-so is mad at you. My brain is always trying to protect me in a way that like, oh, you need to be worrying about this. Oh, you need to be worrying about this. And just outlandish scenarios that would never happen, but that if I did not have this mental illness, I would think, oh, that's, why would I even think about that? That's like, you know, so irrelevant or whatever. So each day I do have thoughts. Some days are better than others. Some days, you know, I wake up with night terrors. Panic attacks are still real, but I am, you know, after 3 years of therapy, things have gotten a lot better due to medication, due to my therapy sessions and things like that.
Wow. Okay. Caleb, we're going to go into a commercial break for just a second, and we'll be right back, everyone. Stay put.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
Everyone, we're back at Answers for the Family with our guest, Caleb Woods, and his book, Harnessing Darkness, Expressing Mental Illness Through Poetry. I would like to show you a question of one of the listeners, Caleb. She writes, her name is Jenna from Texas, and she writes, I really enjoyed writing poetry during college, and think about those poems. I know there were a great release for stress I was under at the time. Now, 10 years into being a mom and a career woman, I'm finding myself needing to see a therapist to deal with the depression and anxiety I am experiencing. I took a look at your book on Amazon, and the poem, Coping to Survive, was a huge wake-up call. That's maybe what I need to do, is to stop coping and to start writing again. I look forward to this interview. I wanted you to know that I bought your book and that I feel inspired, Jenna. I love what she wrote, Caleb, even though I do not know the poem. Could you tell us why you turned to poetry? Because writing is one thing, but poetry is like, to me, that's magic, Caleb.
Oh, well, thank you. and thank you for that question and that comment. I really appreciate that. Yeah, so basically anytime I would have suicidal ideations or experience depression, anxiety, you know, really low, where I would wake up from a night terror or anything, I would write down my thoughts, kind of just in the notes in my phone. And what I ended up doing, some of them just kind of poured out of me onto the page and were poems from the get-go. And some of them I crafted into poetry. And I wanted to make it in a way so that people would, you know, understand what it's like for someone to live with mental illness. Because growing up gay in the Bible Belt, there's been a huge stigma regarding that. But I've also found out through the workplace, through all the things, you know, family, friends, church, everything, the same things as with being gay, there's also a big stigma surrounding mental illness. And I wanted to say, look, here I am. I'm going to be vulnerable. This is the most important thing I need to do. I've always wanted to release a book. I never thought that it would be this. I never thought it would be this subject. But it's so important for other people, because I always see on the news so many young LGBTQ youth, you know, taking their lives and things like that. And it just, it really bothers me that we still have the stigma and people are still treated so poorly. And I really wanted to, you know, bring this topic to light.
But isn't one of the reasons that there's a stigma is not just from people judging people that have mental illness, but just because you're not always capable to express what is wrong with us, right? Like, I'm just going to take an example of something that just happened recently to me. My dad passed away, and someone told me that there was a period to grieve and then basically get over it. So aren't we kind of conditioned to learn to kind of, I'm going to just say it, suck it up, kind of buttercup, right? I heard this expression in the United States and I was kind of really taken aback by it. Do you feel that a little bit, that that's also part of the stigma? Because we do not have the vocabulary to express what we're feeling, and so people kind of dismiss our feelings?
Oh, absolutely. I think that we're told at a young age, you know, suck it up, especially boys and young men.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, don't cry, things like that. Don't feel mm-hmm. your emotions. This creates a hardened, you know, person with a lack of compassion, a lack of empathy. And that's not right, quite frankly. It just isn't. And, you know, for somebody to tell you, oh, well, there's a grieving process. Well, the grieving process never stops. Okay, it never stops. It's like a brick in, it's like a brick in your pocket. Like that weight will always be there, but there mm-hmm. may be times that you're so used to it that you don't think of it every waking second.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Here's another question from the listener. I would like to share that our 17-year-old daughter was cutting herself and doing drugs 2 years ago. She had an amazing turnaround after she started rapping with a few of her friends. Reading about your book has reinforced that our kids need to be encouraged to express themselves and that poetry is important, even when it comes in a form that is a bit foreign to parents like myself. This is Paul in Minnesota. Do you have a response to that?
Sure. That is excellent news. That your daughter was able to find a creative outlet. And, you know, I do believe we need to support that. And that's one thing I do recommend people who are struggling with any type of anxiety or depression is to find something, you know, I believe Carrie Fisher said it best, would take your broken heart and turn it into art. And whether that be poetry or any type of writing or painting, or as, you know, he mentioned, you know, rapping, you know, music, mm-hmm. Anything that you love, you know, starting a blog about your favorite movies or your favorite video games or things like that. For me, one of the things that got me through really difficult times was the television show Lost. And it's been off the air for, you know, several years now, but I've met so many people within that fandom across the world, and I've been to numerous conventions and things like that. And that really, you know, I found a family there that was accepting. People came from all over. And that's why my website, it's called calebislost.com. On social media, I'm Caleb is Lost. That's just always kind of been part of who I am. And at the time, you know, I felt lost in my life, you know, spiritually, emotionally. And it also, you know, went along with, you know, this beautiful show that gave me so much inspiration that I saw personally as my Bible. And so that's why I kept it in terms of when I became an author and things like that, because I thought it kind of went along with everything. And, you know, of course, there are some days you do feel lost and you do feel found with mental illness, because it is such mm-hmm. a roller coaster.
And I'm going to ask you something that most doctors will tell you, that we just have mental illness. But my thing is always, we weren't born with mental illness. Most of us were born whole and complete, meaning we weren't depressed. We didn't have things. And it only started developing by the way we were treated. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so I believe some of my, for me in my situation, I believe partly my mental illness is genetics. But for the majority, I would say that it's environmental factors and just purely the traumas that I've endured that kind of kept happening one after the other. And for some people, it can be one trauma early on in their childhood that affects them later down the road. Other people, like in my case, it was just, back to back to back to back until there was just no not acknowledging it anymore. I was forced to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's why I wondered. I have heard that genetics can be part of mental illness, but I also think our environment has a lot to do with how we feel about ourselves, because belonging is a very intricate part of feeling good about who we are. And if we stand alone and we don't belong, then it's very, very difficult to navigate this world, right?
Absolutely.
So I have a question for you. If anyone is listening out there, a young person, what is the one advice you would give to he or she that is dealing with any kind of struggle or mental illness? What is that one thing that he or she needs to hear from you?
Right. The thing that people who are struggling need to realize, and that I should have realized long ago, is to not wait. To not wait and to take it seriously. Do not wait to get help. If you wait, this will only do more damage, and you need to make sure you have a good support system, find someone you can confide in, do some research to find some good therapists in your area. I'm a strong proponent of therapy, and find people you can trust to talk out your feelings and to not keep them bottled up. Find a good psychologist. Make sure that you're letting it out, whether it's speaking, whether it's, through art, but make sure somebody is aware the whole time and that you have a strong support system. Because in the case of bullying, if you're a parent and you think about it and your kid is bullied as much as I was, and say that 6-7 hours a day, 5 days a week for all these years, school, they need to come home and they need to, they're coming home, 4 or 5 o'clock? And then by 9, 8, they're in bed or whatever. That gives you 4 or 5 hours where you need to have a strong, loving, supportive environment to make up for all those hours at school that are potentially hazardous. So I would just make sure you have a strong support system and to make sure that, family members of those suffering from mental illness are being the strongest support system that they can be.
I love that you said that. But I also realize how hard it is to not wait. I think I see a lot of children and they always believe that somehow they can do it by themselves, that somehow if they're just better people and they try harder, that somehow it will all go away?
Right, yes. And, that was something I thought too. And okay, That's why I want to, my goal is with this book is to put it all out there, be vulnerable, tell your story, make sure people are aware, because that's the only way we can start to help in the stigma of mental illness and that surrounds it, and just to be honest with yourself and your feelings and let others know. And we all have an important story to tell, no matter what type of trauma or experience you've been through. It is important to share it. And as I found from my various book signings and speaking engagements throughout the year, I found that it is healing. It's so healing to just tell your story, to just, you know, put yourself out there.
Absolutely. Thank you, Caleb. And how can people reach you?
Yes, you can find me online on Instagram and Twitter at Caleb is Lost. You can find my author page on Facebook at facebook.com/CalebWoodsWriter. And my main website is CalebIsLost.com, and you can go on there and see all of my events and things like that. And you can find my book, which is called Harnessing Darkness, Expressing Mental Illness Through Poetry. You can find it on Amazon, on BarnesandNoble.com, BooksAMillion.com, you know, various places like that.
Okay. Now, for everyone listening out there, please do not write that down. It will be absolutely on the website, just in case you didn't catch all that. Caleb Woods, thank you so much for being the last guest of 2019 on the show. It's a pleasure, and I wish you a very happy new year.
Oh, of course. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And everybody out there, let's be a little more vulnerable in 2020 and share our stories.
Thank you so much. And please, everyone out there, please put us on the calendar next Monday when we're back with our guest Peter Seth to discuss his new novel, When I Got Out, a story that describes challenges many ex-cons experience when the world they left behind and the world they never knew collide. And for every other person, please do us an enormous favor and subscribe to Answers for the Family by going to iTunes, Stitchers, YouTube, Vimeo, or Spreaker, SoundCloud, and iHeartRadio. And everyone, please have an incredibly happy new year. Be safe out there. And I will, Alan, not I personally, but Alan Cardoza will be back in the new year with a new show. Thank you, everyone.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.